Wondering why water is such a hot topic in Colorado right now?
So, how much water is currently being used in Colorado Springs? On average, about 72,500 acre-feet per year. How much can CSU reliably provide every year? Right now, about 95,000 acre-feet. So, there appears to be some room for growth, right? Maybe not.
Because of the crisis on the Colorado River that has left Lake Mead near Las Vegas and Lake Powell in Utah at record lows, the federal government is looking for ways to send more water downstream. And it's possible a significant amount of water CSU receives every year from the Colorado River Basin could be cut.
Is there really a water crisis? Let's find out on the next episode of Peak Environment. Welcome to another episode of Peak Environment, a Studio 809 community podcast in the Pikes Peak region about environmental integrity and stewardship. Peak Environment is recorded at The Next Us, a professional cooperative environment for small businesses in downtown Colorado Springs. Hey everyone, I'm your host, Allie Richardson, and I'm with Pikes Peak Permaculture, which is an educational 501c3 nonprofit dedicating to teaching the ethics and principles of permaculture design in Southern Colorado. If you're not familiar with permaculture design, it's all about working with nature instead of against it, building stronger connections with our landscape and all inhabitants, regenerating land, water, and food systems, and making sure our region thrives for generations to come. We work with community members, schools, and many organizations to further promote permaculture design for the Pikes Peak region and beyond. You can check out more about what we do at pikespeakpermaculture.org. Aren't we living in a state of abundant supply of fresh water? The answer to that is no. So I'm here with several guests to discuss local water issues and innovative solutions. And the first guest I have here today is Mike Calicrate. Mike Calicrate is an independent cattle rancher out of St. Francis, Kansas. Mike Calicrate owns and operates Ranch Food Direct, which is high quality and safe meat in our region. He just celebrated 25 years doing so. And he has two Colorado locations here, one on Fillmore and a beautiful location, too, on Town Center Drive. Thanks again for coming to the show, Mike. The next person we have here is Mark Robinson. Mark Robinson is a U.S. Air Force veteran. He also is the owner and farmer of Green Hill Farm, which is a grain and vegetable farm in Payton, Colorado, east of Colorado Springs. He uses regenerative growing practices to produce the most nutritious grains and vegetables possible. They're currently improving the soil through permaculture and experimenting with different grains. Thank you and welcome to the show. And then the next guest I have is probably a familiar voice to many who have listened to Studio 809 before, but I have Dave Gardner here. Dave Gardner is the president here at Studio 809. He also is a filmmaker who did the documentary called Growth Busters, Hooked on Growth. He has knowledge of the local initiatives here in the area and has interviewed many guests on various podcasts surrounding our topic today, which I felt was important to bring him in. Yeah, so welcome, too.
Great to be here.
Yeah. So to start off, a lot of people here in the state do not really understand where our water comes from. And so I kind of wanted to start off with that first, just to kind of give people a perspective of the water crisis that we do see ourselves in today. And so, according to 2024 statistics, Colorado Springs water source, 60 to 70% is actually coming from the Colorado River, which travels 175 miles. And then 17% comes from Pikes Peak snowmelt, which here lately we've had less snowpack, so less snowmelt. We also are drawing water from the Arkansas River. And just recently, there was a southern delivery system to irrigate the east side of Colorado Springs from the annexation and the building of Banning Lewis. So that water is being pumped from the Arkansas River right now. So if that says anything, we have no rivers in Colorado Springs. So we are technically living here and we're borrowing the water. The water was never meant to be channeled this way in that excessive amount.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting to note that we began to outgrow our watershed back in the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. you know, over 70 years ago.
Exactly.
And for this town to keep growing, we had to start pumping water from across the Continental Divide in order to keep growing.
That's right. Fountain Creek used to be where the water was drawn, but yeah, the demand got too high.
If I could add a little on that, too, that I refreshed my knowledge of all of this from the Colorado Water Plan. It's a 2023 document. But, the challenge is that 80% of the water falls and flows west in Colorado on the western slope, but 90% of the people live east of the Continental Divide. So every municipality on the Front Range is looking for water from the western side of the state. And so that's the challenge, and that causes the friction.
And so now that we kind of understand where we're getting our water here in the area, we need to also know that these are the headwaters. And we have what's called the doctrine of prior appropriation that we run under, which basically means first in time, first in right. But we're seeing a lot of, I guess, disputes because a lot of the water that we're using, we're supposed to be using beneficially. But I feel like there are a lot of ways where Colorado could adjust what they're doing with the water systems now to where we can see the water flowing and recharging the ground in a natural process. And so I want to go around and just ask you all, what kind of pressures do you see that we're having with the water right now?
Well, I see pressure mainly from developer interests. Mm-hmm. I spoke with a group here, the Colorado Springs Executive Group, in Colorado Springs here a while back, and I was explaining the problem with the Arkansas River not making it to Kansas anymore, mm-hmm. and that therefore is not recharging the Ogallala Aquifer. And the Ogallala Aquifer is everyone's aquifer. It's not just western Kansas and Nebraska and the Texas Panhandle. It is America's food supply. A lot goes on top of the Ogallala Aquifer, and it is disappearing very, very rapidly, down 1.47 feet just last year alone in Garden City, Kansas.
Yeah, what do they say, less than 50 years before it's virtually not of use to us anymore?
I have no idea where they come up with 50 years. All those irrigators are on the boards that say those things, like Groundwater District 4 in northwest Kansas where I live. It's the irrigators. Oh, 50 years. Baloney. It is not going to last that long. Uh-huh. They're already pumping air all up and down the Ogallala. And, mm-hmm. and in many places, Muleshoe, Texas, it's gone completely. And the problem there is they didn't put the land back to grass while they still had some water to get it to grow. And so now you've got blowing dirt. You know, it looks more like the 30s. Mm-hmm. So seriously, seriously mismanaged stuff here. But so my problem is we're drying up the Ogallala Aquifer because we're mm-hmm. diverting the water that was once in the Arkansas River to Colorado Springs and to the Front Range for growth, or for use of what we currently need. And along with that, Dave, I know you'll talk about it, the farms are drying up along Highway 50 in the Arkansas Valley. And again, they didn't plant at the grass when they took the water away. And we've got every year, we've got the tumbleweeds and the dirt blowing down in the valley. And I went to school at Lamar and I years ago, but I really understand how critical water is to that place, to that rural area. But again, we're growing our food with this water, and it really comes down to a choice. Do you want to eat or not? But the thing I was explaining to this executive group was we've got to stop. And one of the developers in the group, I think he might have been the only developer in the group, just stood up and just took the floor. You cannot tell people they can't come here. And of course, you know, that it's in his interests that they do continue to come here. But the bottom line is it's gonna be a real disaster at some point.
And real quick, back to the Ogallala. I mean, it's not just the Arkansas River drying up, but the farmers throughout the, you know, who are above the Ogallala, which is covering how many states?
Eight states. It's one of the world's largest freshwater sources.
They've been pumping, you know, they've all been pumping water out of the out of the Ogallala.
Well, just to give you an example, my well at St. Francis, Kansas, 50 years ago, that well was 250 feet to shale, and it had 100 feet of water in it. Today, it's got 25 feet of water in it.
Wow.
Oh, it's not going to last 50 years. You've got to be, you've got to know that. But here's an example. The well on the Robertson Farm, we've got some beautiful land southeast of St. Francis, some of that deep soil, black dirt. And the Robertsons are, have farmed that for a very long time, and they drilled a well. It's been over 50 years ago. And when the new well was first drilled, it pumped 2,250 gallons per minute. And they've done all the work over the years to keep it in shape and to keep it working. Today, that well is pumping 350 gallons of water per minute, And you know, that's really not enough to grow corn continuously anymore. And so you're starting to see a lot of adjustments being made. You first start seeing they remove a tower off the sprinkler, the circle, the sprinkler, and they recalibrate it, re-nozzle it. First of all, they get rid of the sprinklers and they go to drip and drops and more efficient ways of delivering that water to the plant. But they've done all that already. That's all done. And they're monitoring soil with sensors, and it's all, they've used all the technology they can possibly use. And of course, then they just decide, well, let's quit growing corn and grow wheat. So we're making those, some of those adjustments, but we're not making the big adjustment. The big adjustment is to stop irrigating. And it was so interesting because I was in St. Francis last Sunday. I landed there at the airport, and my friend was sitting there in his hangar. His door was open, and he was just sort of taking it easy. And so I just said, I'm going to stop and talk. So we were visiting, and he is one of the old-time irrigators. He's always irrigated, and he still owns his land. And he, and this water came up, and we were just talking about the new 150,000-head feedlot that's going in at Hagler, Nebraska, 25 miles northwest. You know, and there's all this development that's continuing to go on. Sounds familiar to Colorado Springs and housing and commercial development. And so here we are ignoring the problem with the Ogallala, building the biggest feedlot in the world, 150,000 head feedlot, all on concrete. And it's 25 miles northwest of me, drawing right out of the Ogallala every drop they need, not only for the cattle, but for all the grain and the hay and everything else that those animals are going to consume. And he just simply said, we've got to stop irrigating. And he's got the most to lose. What happens to his land values when you shut the water off? Well, it drops significantly, but he's real. This is a farmer who's irrigated out of the Ogallala since the very beginning, and he's now saying, we simply have to stop. We need to stop now, not just scale back.
Well, it was kind of nuts to start growing all of this food that required irrigation in places that, you know, they didn't have enough water, to where we had to build dams and pump the water. But what are the options? You know, I kind of figured that we're stuck with that now. So what do we do if we stop irrigating? What do we grow?
Well, Dave, I think a lot of the thing we were thinking, though, back in those days, okay, we've got this wonderful underground reservoir of water that's massive, like the Great Lakes, you know.
And, seemed like it would last forever.
Yeah, it would last a long time, but it was also being recharged. So we had the water from the mountains that went east down the rivers from the Arkansas to the Republican to the South Platte to the North Platte. And those rivers actually had water in them. Not anymore. And see, so when we're saying 50 years, that Ogallala may run out in 50 years, we're not calculating the fact that the recharge on the Arkansas has actually stopped because that river doesn't make it to Kansas anymore. I was in Julesburg, Colorado this summer, on my way to South Dakota. I stopped at a museum there, and there was a lady in there that knew quite a lot about what was going on. And I said something to her about, what about the South Platte? How often does it go dry now? How often does the South Platte not make it into Nebraska? And she says, most of the time. Well, the Front Range is using that water. Mm-hmm. And so now Nebraska's wanting to build a canal. What are you going to put in the canal? It's going to be dry. I mean, we're in this big water fight, and we're going to continue to be in a big water fight. But who do you think will win? Who has the most votes?
Well, yeah.
The people are going to win,
yeah.
But they're also going to lose because they're going to run out of water. Mm-hmm. And so we've really got to look at it realistically. The Republican doesn't have water in it anymore, and the Arkansas doesn't make it to Kansas anymore. And the north end of the Ogallala is stronger because the North Platte doesn't run through an urban center. So it's recharging that northern part mm-hmm. in Nebraska better. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, I think everything south of St. Francis, Kansas, to the Texas Panhandle is just going to go dry. And then what are we going to water livestock with? What are we going to, what about homes?
Well, yeah, and I think we're going to have to start making some tough decisions on priorities. And if something should not be grown in a particular location, then we shouldn't do that. We should go where the water is. And so in Colorado, I'm fairly new to this farmer game. I had a long engineering career, and so I started this farm thinking, well, more local growing near Colorado Springs makes sense. But, after doing it for 5 years, I'm kind of wondering if that makes sense. And my aquifer, I'm actually in one aquifer now and going to put a well into another aquifer. But there's the 100-year rule about determining what your right is based on 100-year life of that aquifer. But if it's not recharging, then, we're doing some math that's meaningless. And it really is just simple math. So maybe that should be a 200-year or a 300-year determination. And if the recharge is actually shut off, then that shouldn't be tapped at all. You got to let it recover. But, there's some crops that just – alfalfa is a perfect one. It's great for cattle, but that's a 40-inch-a-year crop. And so
right.
– and mm-hmm. we get maybe 10, 12 inches from the heavens. So maybe we shouldn't be growing that here. Mm-hmm. And I did a CSU extension trial one summer – with cowpeas. It didn't work in my location, but the idea was to find an alternative to alfalfa that could feed cattle, but also could be a human staple as well, because cowpeas, if you've heard of black-eyed peas, you've eaten a cowpea, so mm-hmm. it's just a variety of cowpea. So, some of those sorts of things I think we need to start doing, and any use of surface water is better than tapping an aquifer.
Just to show you how ignorant decision makers can be and courts can be. In St. Francis, we've got the reservoir, Bonnie Reservoir, that is just west of us on the state line. Wonderful recreation, body of water, a bird preserve, a game preserve, just a awesome feature. A lot of people came out from Denver to boat and camp for many years. So in part of the settlement with the state of Kansas, Colorado decided to drain that reservoir. So it's now dry. There's nothing in it. And in addition to that, they are pumping water from November to March at thousands of gallons per minute out of the Ogallala Aquifer up near Laird, Colorado, and putting it on top of the ground where it just goes down a creek and runs out and goes dry. It is the most unbelievable and ridiculous use of it. It's just a squandering of this precious fossil resource. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of settlements we're getting out of these water fights. And you mentioned that channel or canal that they want to build up in northeastern Colorado to mm-hmm. get so Nebraska gets their fair share of the South Platte, which is just another stupid lawsuit and a terrible plan, because what if there's no water in the South Platte? So the solutions we're coming up with are totally wrong and simply don't work. But going back to my conversation with my farmer friend in St. Francis on Sunday, who irrigates and always has irrigated, he said, we got to go back dry land. And he mm-hmm. said, land that isn't suitable, that there's a lot of land that's irrigated now mm-hmm. that's not suitable dry land. Mm-hmm. And that land needs to be put back to grass, put that into the CRP program, mm-hmm. Conservation Reserve Program. get those acres, you know, covered and put them back to grass. And then if we can ever get a cattle market someday, mm-hmm. hopefully, then we need to increase our beef herd, which we obviously don't produce enough to feed ourselves. So that would be a nice thing to do. So overall, a bigger plan would be to put the more marginal land that's irrigated, mm-hmm. that all goes back to grass. The other irrigated land is dry land, and it's good land. Just go back to growing wheat and mm-hmm. barley and those dry land crops that need no irrigation. Mm-hmm. You know, you go back to the every other year, you know, summer fallowing type mm-hmm. of a program. That works well, mm-hmm. and we can continue to feed cattle in Kansas. It'll everything still works mm-hmm. fine. And we don't deplete the aquifer. Mm-hmm. And then, Mark, like you said, let's grow corn and soybeans and alfalfa where it rains.
Yeah.
Get back there. I mean, you just got to go to Great Bend, Kansas, mm-hmm. and you get 30 inches of rainfall a year. That's yeah. double what we get. Mm-hmm. That's yep. not that far away.
Yeah.
We've got plans that make yeah. sense, but the developers have a big, big reason not to listen.
Yep. Well, and all the states around us, too, need to be a part of this, too. I don't think this was mentioned up front, but all the water flowing out of Colorado from all the different basins feed 18 other states. You know, that water goes to 18 other states and Mexico, although it doesn't get that far anymore either. Mexico doesn't get a drop, I don't believe. So what they're doing with their share of water, the math was done way back over 100 years ago. You know, that needs to be questioned, too, because maybe growing lettuce in southern Arizona and southern California doesn't make any sense. Those are deserts. You know, why are we growing food there? Or why are they growing food there? But, you know, all these states are kind of defending their turf, and they don't want anything to change. But something's got to change. Most of the water leaves Colorado is through the Colorado River. But this applies, we've been talking a lot about eastern Colorado and western Kansas, because that's right. where we live. But
if 60-70% of our water comes from the Colorado River, that's it directly impacting mm-hmm. downstream
oh, yeah.
what's available for those people. And they're talking about Lake yep. Powell not producing energy next year.
Yeah, and I think that's why we hear so much more concern here in the region about water. People, I started working on the Growth Busters documentary back in about 2005, because the drought that we had just begun here in the American Southwest around 2001, I think it was, I thought, you know what, limits to water are going to be the thing that makes us maybe get over our addiction to growth. Mm-hmm. I can't believe it's taken us 20 more years to finally start worrying about it, but we are now because of all the headlines about the Colorado River. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even most of the water we pump out of the Arkansas River for Colorado Springs actually came out of the Colorado River. We mm-hmm. diverted it and pumped it and moved yeah. it into the Arkansas so we wouldn't have to run that many pipes and that many pumps.
Yeah.
And so we've got we've got Utah, Arizona, California, Idaho, a little bit New Mexico, all of these states that mm-hmm. tap into the Colorado River, mm-hmm. and they are all trying to renegotiate the shares of water that they take from the Colorado, because it's become real obvious mm-hmm. that there's not as much water in the yep. river and now yeah. as they thought there was.
I've been looking for somebody to help me understand how Mexico owes us water. You know, you've heard on the news here lately that Mexico owes us water, and we're going to, by God, get it back. And I think they're downhill from us.
There yeah. is some.
I don't understand that one either.
There is at least one river that runs from Mexico back into the U.S., but it's very polluted.
You can't, we maybe
yeah,
don't want
it's
that.
It's not usable.
Yeah,
it,
yeah, you don't
fact,
want to
it
use run, it.
It comes in around the San Diego area, right?
Well, I don't know about that. The one I've seen is closer to. Closer to Yuma, Arizona.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to study up on that. But yeah. I just really wondered how they were going to pay us back. because it looks to me like we're using more than our fair share.
Yeah.
Of course.
And they're not getting what they – and again, they're running into the same problem yeah. as we are. How are they going to continue to feed us fruits and vegetables when their aquifers are drying up? And I was in Chihuahua and out on a wonderful farm, a Mennonite farm, there northeast of Chihuahua. Circle pivots everywhere on a seriously declining aquifer.
Now, see, if we really do stop a lot of the irrigated agriculture, that frees up a lot of water for municipalities to keep on growing. Because we only use, let's see, what is it? Agriculture uses, what, 80, something like 90, 80%?
90% in Colorado.
Of the water goes to agriculture. So that's a lot of water. But we don't really want to repurpose it that way.
You look at the Arkansas Valley, though, that is a special place that's got good soil and good water and is capable of feeding us very well. And to take water from that land is 100%. Totally irresponsible.
Yeah.
Totally irresponsible. To shut down some pivots out in Yuma, Colorado, that are on sandy, you know, rolling ground, come on, they shouldn't be farming that anyway.
Right. But you bring up a good point, because if we, you know, we have to get the food from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the farther away it is, the more fossil fuels we're burning to transport that food here.
Right. But one of the things I don't think we think about a lot is, why would the farmers in the Arkansas Valley be willing to sell their water? Why would they be willing to separate the water from the land? And the answer is because they've never made money. In the last two generations, at least, they've just stolen what they produce, and they've had to compete with Mexico and Salinas, California, and various places that produce for less. Mm-hmm. And the big companies, the big retail stores, the big food service companies, those who buy massive amounts of produce, leverage those other supplies from Mexico and California against the Arkansas Valley growers to make sure they lose money.
Yeah.
They lose money every single year. And they say it's supply and demand, whatever they want. But the fact is, it's stealing. The big food companies have stolen the produce from the Arkansas Valley long enough that they have made them willing sellers of their land and their water. And of course, during that time of pain, when farmers couldn't pay their bills and were eating their equity in their land and borrowing more money, the kids did not want to come back to something like that. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have the next generation willing to grow our food. So we've made some big mistakes.
Yeah.
And we really need to dig down and figure out exactly what makes sense to solve some of these issues.
And you say willing sellers, they're still reluctant. They would really rather not be having to sell.
They'd rather do anything than sell their land.
Yeah. But they have rising pumping cost, and the water availability is diminishing. So it's really difficult. It's really a hard thing. And, you know, that's why you see a lot of farmers really kind of depressed and mad at the world. And I will bring this up because you mentioned stolen water. How do you feel about the foreign land ownership that's happening right now in our states? So, of course, there's increased water competition all over the world. We know this. But here in the West, it's starting to be what some people call unfair because it's not considered a beneficial use. There is approximately 2.5 million acres of farmland owned by foreign entities, making it the third largest amount of foreign-held agricultural land in the U.S. And so as a farmer and a rancher who depends on this water to keep flowing to feed our communities, how do you feel about that?
I don't like that in the least, but I don't know about the Colorado ownership. I hadn't looked into that yet, but I did read an article about a Saudi Arabian company that had bought land in Arizona, I believe it was, with water rights, and Arizona does not. I mean, it's just wide open. If you've got the right, you can do whatever you want with it. And so they've got hundreds or thousands of acres where they're growing alfalfa. And why are they doing that? Because in Saudi Arabia, growing alfalfa is banned. You can't grow alfalfa in Saudi Arabia because it takes too much water. So they do it here, and then they ship all that alfalfa for their horses.
They're taking our water.
Taking our water to feed their horses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just put it into the alfalfa for shipping.
That's an extreme example. I don't know what the foreign ownership in Colorado, what they're doing with their land. But I know China's buying up a lot of land for the future because they know that to feed their people, they may have to be farming in other countries.
So that's more scary for us, isn't it, to know that?
Yeah.
But you look at the Saudis, they're taking precious water that we would be better off growing food for. Mm-hmm. We are a net food importer.
Yes.
We do not grow enough food in our country to feed ourselves.
That's crazy.
But the thing is, they don't want just the water. They need a farmer to turn it into something of value. Mm-hmm. Water is a precious resource, but you've got to turn it into food. or you've got to turn it into corn or soybeans or something mm-hmm. else. And so when I look at Yuma, Colorado, for example, which is a real center of industrial agriculture, they've still got a stronger aquifer there than we have in St. Francis, Kansas. But you've got JBS, you got Cargill, you've got the big corporations that are benefiting from the water. Talk about beneficial use. But they need someone to turn it in to something they can use, whether it's cattle or corn or silage or whatever it may be. And so they're basically mining our water for products that produce products below our cost of production. So it's not just taking our water for their profits as a corporation. They're taking our labor. They're wearing out our farm operators. They're wearing out the land. They're wearing out the machinery. Everything is produced below cost of production because these companies have the power to pay less than what it costs to produce. But water is the key. As soon as that water is no longer available, they're gone. They go somewhere else in the world. And you know, people say all the time, well, why would a corporation act contrary to its own self-interest by overpumping an aquifer or underpaying for cattle, you know, liquidating half our ranchers and 10 million cows? And the answer is for their short-term profit.
Yeah, they're focused on the near term, not the long term.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it is a really big global issue, this, So, Mike, I think it was you that brought up China, or maybe it was you, Mark. You know, China knows it's going to need to import food from a lot of all parts of the world it can in order to feed the population that it hopes it will have, because it's busy trying to reverse its population decline. Why? Because they're hooked on economic growth, and they can't keep their GDP growing as their population contracts, and their population is starting to contract. Well, it's really pretty smart to let your population contract if you can't feed that population. But they don't look at it that way. They think, well, we just need to get our hooks into the food market around the world so that we can keep mm-hmm. growing our population and our people won't starve mm-hmm. without regard for people in the other countries. So we're in the beginning of this global bidding war mm-hmm. for food and water mm-hmm. and that doesn't look pretty. And I want to real quick close the circle on the Colorado River and the local concerns here. So the city of Colorado Springs has done a good job of finding water to mm-hmm. feed the growth of this city. And we have a lot of water rights, and we have a lot of infrastructure, and we have enough water to keep growing this city for some time. But the people are nervous, and appropriately so, because the federal government could at any point in time severely restrict how much water we can take from the Colorado mm-hmm. River, because we do have to compete with the other states that depend on water from that river too. So even though we've mm-hmm. got these rights and the infrastructure and everything, we just don't have any certainty that we'll be able to keep pumping that water, and we probably won't at some point. And you mentioned the lake levels. Lake Powell, mm-hmm. it's been 30 years since Lake Powell was at its historic high level. And I think Lake Mead, the last time the elevation of Lake Mead was over 1,200 feet was something like 20 years ago. So it's not looking good.
No, it's alarming. It's strange that more people aren't really concerned about the conservation efforts or doing mm-hmm. different things, or even just at a citizen level, you know. For instance, reclaiming water, reclaim mm-hmm. water, the gray water. 2 years ago, rainwater collection off of your roof was legalized. So these are like things that you can do just as a listener, just to kind of help, you know, not turn your tap on, but instead think, okay, where else can I get the water from? Permaculture design, which is what, you know, of course I teach, is pretty amazing solutions, not only just on the small level, but on a larger macro scale, because we teach people about earthworks and about swaling and catching the water and slowing it down and spreading it and sinking it into the ground. It was USDA and the Colorado Geological Survey, they just recently stated that at the rate that we're going right now, the aquifer will be depleted within the century, and it will take 6,000 years to recharge at the rate we're going. That's not enough for the future, the future generations ahead, or even the wildlife. We're not the only ones who depend on the water. So it really is going to, and I want to move this conversation into that. What are some innovative things that you're doing on your farm, Mark, or your ranch that are helping, or even your outreach to, you know, your community members? Are you seeing people jump on board and realize this, or is it just kind of crickets?
You know, I was just, you made me think, you're talking about rehydrating the landscape.
And, yes.
And is it P&J Cattle Company up on the mountain here that have the yaks and the cattle up there? Mm-hmm. They were fighting the state, who was trying to get them to tear out some of the swales and the ponds that were catching water and rehydrating that landscape, adding to the aquifer, and they were trying to get them to tear it out. And it's kind of like catching your roof water. They didn't want you catching your roof water because they wanted it to end up in Fountain Creek and in the Arkansas, by way of wiping out the Hanna Ranch and 40 acres of alfalfa or whatever it took that one rain. But so anyway, there's some really wrongheaded thinking around this. And if we can rehydrate our landscapes in the cities, if we could keep the water and make it, get it to go into the ground, it would be so beneficial because it's stored there and it's available there. Mm-hmm. Right. Rather than it, like in Australia, where they get the monsoon, huge, massive rains that just wash everything and then you've got a desert again. Mm-hmm. If they could just hold it, it changes the climate.
Absolutely. And there's, and I'm sure, Mark, you might have seen this. Yeah. There's a gentleman named Zach Wise, and he has a wonderful series of animated illustrations that show the water cycle in the way that it's actually happening, where it's really important to not only read the landscape, but read the way the water is moving in the landscape. Mm-hmm. You were saying that the water can be held in the landscape. Absolutely. And that's in trees. And then trees trans evaporate that water into the atmosphere with bacterium. And that is actually what causes a raindrop. So if anybody hasn't seen those, highly recommend it. And I'm glad you brought up the city. Yes, the city can rehydrate the landscape. We can be a huge benefit to getting that water percolated back. Mm-hmm. And the rainwater collection, you know, that was a great thing that they allowed the people, the citizens. But there are limitations. We're only allowed 2 barrels and only 110 gallons, which, you know, it's not enough. I don't believe. And then, you know, you did talk about too, like just the different landscape. The state right now, they have a turf replacement program from a House bill called 2211-51, and they are urging residents of Colorado to plant native grasses, to plant native things. Don't rock your landscape, and please do not rip your lawn out. Cover, smother, because you're going to kill the bacteria and you're going to kill the processes that actually help that water percolate. Once you start to see that process and how it works, you really can be involved in it, and it can be really a powerful thing if more people jump on. We can have the rivers running again through the recharging of these underground waterways.
Yeah, to add to that, I mean, there's some things I do on the farm that maybe wouldn't apply to somebody's backyard here in the Springs, but something that's overlooked, I think, many times is soil health. If you've got a poor soil and you have a heavy rainfall, that soil is not going to hold that water. It's going to run off and cause it to your yard to look like a desert after a while. I mean, it's just not gonna work. But if you've got high organic matter in that soil and lots of roots and high microbial activity, then that soil can hold a lot of water. And for every 1% increase in organic matter in soil on an acre, it holds another, I think it's 18,000 gallons. An acre is only 209 feet by 209 feet. So we're not talking a big area, but 1% increase and you get another 18,000 gallons of water holding capacity. And then you add another percent. It takes a while to up the organic matter in your soil, but it can absolutely be done. So the healthier your soil is, the better you are as well, regardless of what you're growing. But I agree with you. Forget the bluegrass and forget the hardscapes. You know, just the rock or concrete, that's not the answer either.
You know, when our farmers are in trouble, you can't eat your lawn. So at this point, it's really lovely. Like for me, I'm growing a food forest in my neighborhood, a big suburbia area, and it's lawn, lawn, lawn. And then, whoa, what's she doing over there? But I'm giving berries to my neighbors, and I'm, you know, I'm showing them the fruit guilds and these trees. You know, I planted them now, but in 10 years time, I'm going to have so much to offer you and share, and you can have this too. It's just and it can be done on a small scale, Mark. You know, you can build soil.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mulch, you know, just going to Recreation Way here in town. You can load up a bag or a box or your truck bed, a free mulch from the city. It's a wonderful resource. And you do that for a couple years, you're going to be amazed when you pull back that layer of mulch at the life, the biota, the richness. You can smell it, you know, and the mycorrhizal, you know, the fungus are breaking down things and making the nutrients available to plants. We cannot feed artificial stuff to plants and then eat that and think that that's beneficial to us. It's just not the way it works.
Another thing people can do is be choosy about what you plant. And by that I mean not just, you know, don't buy hybrids, buy heirloom. And, but beyond that, if you can, buy seed that's been grown nearby so that it's already acclimated to the Colorado climate. It's called epigenetics. A seed will remember what the mother plant experienced the season before, so you can have an immediate impact. So if you save your seed, that's even better. So I try to do that. I don't buy any seed from back east or Georgia or North Carolina or whatever, because I know that's just an uphill battle.
Yeah, and you cannot grow your seed from your Mexican fruit that you got because it's not the climate here. So if you try to plant that seed, it's not going to do well.
Right. And if it was a hybrid, you'll get something different than what you were expecting too. I guess that's how genetics works. But so be choosy about what you plant and try to grow things that are low water. And I'm trying to do that to adapt for my wheat. You know, there's some wheats that just don't grow well in Colorado, and typically spring wheat in Peyton does not do well. So it's got to be winter wheat, and then you just hope for some good spring rain. You know, but our weather patterns have been disrupted as well. So
yeah, we're in the process of not ripping out our turf, but converting our turf to native grasses that are more drought tolerant, don't need no fertilizer, almost no watering whatsoever. Gone are the days of the daily shower. We only drink wine and beer, no water. Just kidding.
Well, there is that saying that whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. That applies.
And, you know, a lot of the people in Colorado Springs have been doing a good job. Oh, and low flush toilets and not flushing every time you use the toilet. It takes a while to kind of get the household adjusted to that.
I think about all the times we've been told to shorten up the shower. And, you know, even some people put a bucket in their shower and catch the water. And then I look at the irrigation system pumping 1,000 gallons a minute. And just how dang much good that does, you know. Come on, let's try to hit it bigger. Let's shut down that 1,000 gallon.
That's where we can.
In addition to a lot of other things, and the awareness is important. But out in our country, in eastern Colorado and on the Kansas border, we just want to see more land and grass. And that be healthy soil absorbs.
That's what wants
rapidly.
To grow there.
And rather than have it run down the gullies and washing out the topsoil, I mean, if you fly over eastern Colorado, you can't believe how much topsoil is gone. It's white dirt. And it takes a lot of fertilizer to grow those crops. And of course, the government subsidizes and they keep the farmers on the land to a large extent. But it's simply we're losing more and more topsoil every year, and we've got to stop that. So I'm saying, put it back to grass, put a mix in to where livestock can get a more complete diet, and just absorb, get that water to go into that landscape and stay there and rebuild these and recharge these aquifers and see some streams come alive again.
Well, that's going to come from being responsible here in this city, though, and I don't think our educational outreach is where it needs to be to educate our citizens to use water, you know, efficiently, which is why I do this podcast. I'm trying to reach people and share these things that our governments are failing to address with us. And so, yeah, the techniques of shorter showers and, you know, yellow mellow, don't flush. These are great, but they're just not enough. Yeah. And so, you know, I mentioned earlier, gray water is going to be huge. And that's basically where you can use your water from your shower, mm-hmm. or you can use your water from your laundry, and that gets diverted outside into basins, which can help other areas that you're growing in. But it can just, again, just get to that land and soak through, so you're not running it down the stormwater drain, down the streams like jet engine train where it erodes like crazy, you know. It's just a mindset change. And right now, Colorado, the state, did pass the gray water law. That was Regulation 86. And, you know, a lot of municipalities and jurisdictions have went ahead and adopted it as written, including Fort Collins, Golden, Castle Rock, Denver City and County just recently did, and they're holding classes for people to come in and learn how to divert laundry to landscape. And if we can get people to do this, just think about how big of a dent that could make for the waters that are usually being diverted. You know, you shouldn't have to turn your tap on just to go out and water some of your vegetables or something, you know, your herb garden. That could be easily done through your rain collection, too. So just the reusing water. In permaculture, we think of things, no waste. That's a principle. So we don't want to waste the water, and reusing it is just a way you cannot waste it. But capturing and storing, you know, we've got to get it in the land. We just really have to. And again, I know that's really hard for people to understand, like, how does getting water in the land make the waters run? But again, watch Zach Wise. Watch those water stories, and it'll become clear to you that, wow, this is really where we need to be going.
So besides reuse, I'll bring up one other thing that people aren't going to really want to hear, I don't think, but I think that's where we're headed, and that's recycling the water. So reuse it as much as we can, and then when the city is providing fresh water to the citizens, some of that may have to be recycled water. It may have to be cleaned up and then put through the water system again. And I know a lot of people don't like the idea of drinking water that used to be sewage, but when you think about it, every molecule of water that we're using right now has been on this planet for billions of years. We reuse water that went through a dinosaur
pee. That's right. Yeah. I tell the kids that work with. We're drinking dinosaur pee.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we've been doing it all along anyway, we can get our heads around that.
We're flushing our feces down in our drinking water right now.
Yes.
Yeah. I would really like us to move towards something also not very comfortable for people, is dry toilets. I was staying in Montana at a permaculture place by Paul Wheaton. He had a program up there where we allowed people to come and see these things in action. And it was just really amazing after the 2 years of being fallow that he could take it and put it on his willow trees, and it would be nutritious and not a resource, again, that's being sent down the waterway. And as headwaters, you know, I think about it when we flush our water, like, we're sending our poo down to everybody else, and I don't think that's okay.
And that is a problem in the lower Arkansas Valley where they can't drink the water. They have to bring in their fresh water for their own use. They've got this huge water resource flowing past them, and they can't drink it.
Because of the contamination.
It's contaminated.
And the city's been sued, I think, sometimes, too, in the past, for the contamination coming down Fountain Creek and stuff, too.
Yep.
Yeah.
One of the things I think about with Colorado Springs and the growth problem, there's a lot of people who want to live here. It's a beautiful place. Right. But there's a lot of people that would have rather stayed where they were. And I look at the importance of trying to build a more fair economy. And from rural America, where I come from in St. Francis, Kansas, it's a ghost town. Mm-hmm. It is dying for lack of income. And if we could get a more fair economy where farmers could actually make money farming again, mm-hmm. and livestock producers could make money producing livestock again, and break up the monopoly that controls these prices and our food system, put more people back out in the country and take the pressure off the cities. I mean, it's like an exodus from rural America into the urban centers. Same thing is happening in China. and other places all around the world. But that comes with concentrated power and wealth. It's never been more concentrated than it is today. And I'm saying enforce some antitrust laws, bring Lena Khan back into the Federal Trade Commission, and let's keep working at making markets more fair and income disparities less.
Yeah, if you give opportunity to people and hope, then they're going to stay, you know, closer to home.
Right. Yeah, that's coming. I mean, it's relocalization and re-ruralization is coming as we start to have to pay the real true cost of burning fossil fuels. People will want to be and need to be closer to their food, and they'll be more interested. They're already showing more interest in growing their own food. Yeah. So it's going to come back. I don't know if you're going to see it in your lifetime, but it's going to come back.
But the problem with homesteading right now is that the people that are trying to do it are finding out you need two jobs off farm.
Yeah. Very hard. And the other, but also our, you know, we could get out of the, we could get out of the business of trying to convince people to move away from wherever they were on the land or other cities to move into our cities. The American West is really doesn't need more people in their municipalities demanding more water. We're just going to be doubling and redoubling our efforts to, you know, to shower once a month, and you know we're going to be desperate to find ways, and we are now, unfortunately, desperate to find ways to keep providing water in the city of Colorado Springs so the city can keep growing. And you know, we can't tell people that they can't move here, but we can stop competing with all the other cities for population growth and measuring our success based on how many people are moving here. You have different metrics and stop subsidizing the growth and poaching. Right now, you know, if we're creating jobs, we're poaching an employer from some other community to move here, and then many of their employees move here, and that makes the home builders happy, but it puts more pressure on the water system in a place that's dry, that only gets 15 inches of water a year. So we need to get out of that game where we're competing for more growth.
So one thing that we haven't mentioned that just occurred to me is market mechanisms to change behavior, including farmers. I mean, if we're using 90% of the water, then we need to contribute as well to reverse this problem. But market mechanisms like tiered rates, I think Colorado Springs Utilities did the right thing when they added tiered rates for water use, so that you pay a low fee for the first, whatever it is, 1,100 cubic feet or whatever it is, and then you pay more for the next block, and you pay even more for the third tier. And so that gets people's attention when all of a sudden their water bill goes from $80 to $400. You know, they say, whoa, what happened?
Well, we're going to see that, too, here in the Springs. Here in the Springs, from 4 to 9 p.m., I advise you not to run your dishwasher. Don't run your washing machine, because the rates are going to be really high during those times.
Yeah, for electricity.
But I could see that very well for water.
Oh, yeah, totally. And then I think that could apply to farmers, too. I don't pay for the gallon that I pump from my pond. I have a right to it, and it's basically free. You know, one thing we didn't mention is the water in Colorado is all owned by the people. It's a common resource. But if you have a water right, then that's property, and so then you can buy and sell that. That's where it kind of shifts from a commons kind of resource to an owned resource. But once I have the right and have the system in to do whatever, I can just dump it on the ground, and there's nobody saying you can't do that. But if I had to pay, if it was metered and somebody was going to say, if you exceed this amount, you then have to send us a check, that would change my behavior completely. I'd be thinking about what I'm growing.
And, you know, water is much more than just a resource that we need for we human beings. We haven't even had time to talk about the welfare of the other species on the planet who all, you know, disrupt their home when we build a dam to store water. We disrupt their home when we pipe water or any of the things that we're doing to store water, take it out of nature and keep it around so that it's ready when we need to turn on the tap. That's that's doing a lot of damage to all kinds of wildlife. And
oh, the migratory birds are having a really hard time right now finding water sources between their routes.
Yeah. And eventually that comes back to bite us. So even if somebody says, oh, I don't care about nature, you will care about nature when everything collapses and suddenly we can't grow food. And
Right, we're part of it. Nature's not out there. Nature is us.
Yeah,
right. Water is life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that we're having this conversation and I'm watching the rain coming down in buckets here outside. So this is, I don't know, it just fits.
It's life, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
So I just want to say, too, we've kind of talked about some tips and things that citizens can do, or farmers or ranchers. Supporting local food saves a ton of water. For instance, you talked about, that feedlot coming. For each time an animal is processed in that manner, you had mentioned 700 gallons of water.
Yes, the big meat packers, your Tyson, Cargill, JBS, Marfrig-type slaughterhouses, use over 700 gallons of water per animal processed. At my place in St. Francis, where we slaughter on-site, on the farm, the cattle don't get on trucks. They just walk into a facility. We use between 30 and 50 gallons of water per animal processed.
Wow.
Just an example of the savings that's possible. If you don't have hundreds of thousands of square feet of plant running two shifts and then needing a full washdown at the end. That's where the real water comes in, is in when they turn on the fire hoses to wash these places down. So, and then we reuse our water. So our water, even what little water we do use, goes right into a pond, and then it's beneficial use from there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. By the way, just to interrupt, not part of the podcast, but I did silence that. That was an emergency alert, I think, about the storm.
I wasn't going to let you ignore that emergency alert.
Yeah, that
alert.
Was one of the, I thought it was an Amber alert.
Now, mine vibrated. I don't know why mine didn't wake me up. If I was asleep, I'd be in big trouble.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, we're not on the Guadalupe, at least.
Okay. Anyway,
right.
Yeah. Back to the podcast.
So I do have one more thing that I did want to mention. Davey mentioned growing population and how that puts a strain, especially for the people who are getting the water downstream from us. As the demand continues, there's also going to be climate change happening at the same time. And that's kind of concerning, too, with the hotter temperatures, because that's going to cause more water to evaporate. So if we're channeling the water and stuff, we're losing a lot of that water, too. And so we need to take action and address these things right now.
A lot of farmers would argue with you about climate change, ranchers and the rural folks. But when I first went to St. Francis, Kansas, it would have been 1972. And I saddled a horse every day, and I heat detected cows, and it rained, and when it rained all over western Kansas and eastern Colorado in a beautiful, widespread system. That just does not happen anymore.
Right.
It just hasn't happened for years. Mm-hmm. Now the moisture we get comes by way of a thunderstorm. Just like we're getting outside right now. It's a downpour.
Uh-huh.
Yep. They're highly eroding land and just it doesn't go into the landscape and it doesn't cover. So here I am in St. Francis. We got an inch of rain and things are looking okay, but in McCook, Nebraska, 90 miles away, they haven't had any rain since February. Well, that drought broke, but that's just the way it is these days. We don't get the general systems that used to really do a great job of providing rainfall.
Right.
Yeah, really good point. We've built a house of cards, and it's very fragile. And climate change is we're not ready to weather. Yeah.
We're not resilient at all.
Mm-mm.
So those listening, please reach out to us at studio809podcast.com, or you can reach out to us at pikespeakpermaculture.org. Mike at
just mycalicrate.com.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my web.
You can reach out to Mike that way. And then, Mark, you have a website, too, as well?
I don't have a website yet.
Oh.
I've been so busy building the farm and farming that I haven't gotten around to that yet.
Good. You've got your priorities straight.
Yeah. I'm not a Luddite, but I will have one. Colorado Grain Chain is where a lot of people contact me through. But, yeah, we'll see. I'm a little behind on making that happen this year, I think. But I do plan to plant some winter wheat this fall, and we'll see how that goes. Dry land.
Right.
Yeah.
And Dave can be found at
growthbusters.org, or just search for the Growth Busters podcast if you're a podcast listener. And Allie, thank you for producing and hosting episodes of Peak Environment. I'm really proud of the Peak Environment podcast and thrilled that Pikes Peak Permaculture is a content partner here, creating really good material for our local citizens to become better informed and engaged on these subjects.
Thank you for that. And I'm delighted to be here because I have knowledge and I need to share it. I need to share it because I know that it could be a better place for us all. Not just humans. It could be a better place for us all.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Allie. Yeah. It was a real pleasure to be among this group right here. I love these guys and the work that they do. And I just encourage people to pay more attention to less consumption and more about being a citizen in a community, helping others.
You know, fair share. Right.
Yeah, and if I could just add, as I think about this, we've talked about a lot of good things people can do, but one thing I think, and we talked earlier about some of the conflict between Western Slope and the Front Range and the Front Range and the Lower Arkansas Valley and things like that, but I think what I'm seeing more of is finally more dialogue and cooperation, collaboration, compromise, and I think it's going to take all of that in order to make this work for everybody rather than lawyering up and going to court and trying to solve it that way, because you get really stupid outcomes if you go that route. But if people are just talking to each other and trying to figure out how, you know, good solutions for solving these problems for everybody, then it'll be fine.
I agree, Mark. And moving into more of a simple lifestyle, you'll find actually is more rewarding.
Yep. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Peak Environment. Be sure to check out all the community podcasts, Studio 809, where we are engaging, informing, and connecting people in the Pikes Peak region.